couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films from this week, Spider-Man Far From Home and Midsommar. I'll also be talking about some retro reviews of The Last Starfighter and Ma and Pa Kettle on Vacation. There's also going to be some news, the Trailer Park and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Dumbo and Cinderella. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is a rest in peace, not to a person, but to an institution. It was announced this past week that Mad Magazine will be ceasing publication. New content is going to continue through, I think, the August issue. And then they're going to continue to make reprints to fulfill subscription orders for people who have active subscriptions. But for all intents and purposes, Mad Magazine is no more. And that's sad because, I mean, Mad Magazine was, that was a big deal. I mean, it's been around for like 67 years. And what's interesting about it is almost explicitly a print institution and online stuff. They did some digital stuff in the past. Now there was Mad TV, which had really not a whole lot to do with the Mad Magazine, but they had Mad TV, which was a competitor to Saturday Night Live, and you saw some comedians rise out of that. And they had one attempt to do a movie called Up the Academy, which they essentially tried to do in the 80s what National Lampoon did with Animal House and Vacation, where they lent their name to a movie and said, you know, Mad Magazine presents, and then they did this. Basically, it was a teen sex comedy. I've seen it. It's not really that good. And it flopped when it came out, but they promoted it as Mad Magazine presents Up the Academy. And they even had a little picture of Alfred E. Newman, like a guy with a rubber mask of Alfred E. Newman waving at the camera, the original marketing for it. But it never really clicked as a thing that would make movies. The only other thing that I really ever remember Mad stretching out to do was they did a board game in the 80s, which is a lot of fun to do because it's just absurd and silly. It's a nonsense game, but it's kind of this weird controlled nonsense. And I actually still have my Mad Magazine game, and I've played it with my kids, and it's a lot of fun for the younger kids. But Mad Magazine was unique in the sense, yes, they had Cracked, and yeah, they had these other humor magazines, but Mad Magazine, especially if you go back to the stuff they did in the 60s and 70s in particular, the Mad Magazine jokes in there, they were sometimes pretty highbrow. And that went through the 80s. I remember as a kid, you know, you read it as a kid and you're like, oh yeah, the Don Martin stuff's funny and Spy versus Spy is funny. But there was like some deep level stuff in the satire that no like 9-year old went to school and was like, oh yeah, they really gave it to Brezhnev in that last joke. No, the kids were talking about the poop jokes and the fart jokes and the gross out humor and that sort of thing. But there was stuff in there for adults. And I remember we got a subscription when I was a kid. So this would have been early 80s, I think. And my dad would read it as much as we would. And then in the 90s, I got my sister a subscription for a birthday or a Christmas or something like that. So we had this big stack of Mad Magazines from the Clinton years. The magazine has changed over the years. Originally, they wouldn't do any sort of advertising. And I remember sometime in the 90s or into the 2000s, they started to put advertising on there. And I knew that was writing on the wall. There's more satire out there readily available through the internet. There's cartoons, there's comics, there's websites that do satire well, like The Onion, and then there's ones that don't, which contributed to fake news becoming a thing. Mad Magazine always knew what it was doing, and it always knew what its audience was, and it did so with irreverent humor and splattery humor and gross-out humor all at the same time. And that was kind of the peak performance of Mad Magazine. And it's sad to see it go. I'm assuming it's because of, you know, it's expensive to do original content. Pay for your content, people. Original content ain't cheap, and it takes time and it takes money. And at some point, if you think you're going to get it all for free because you like Happiness and Cyanide for free online, or you like the oatmeal for free online, you should still patronize Mad Magazine, or you should have been. But since you're not, the print magazine is gone. The other little piece of news I want to hit really quickly, and I'm going to breeze through this, is the Little Mermaid remake, the live-action remake that Disney is doing, has cast its Little Mermaid, and it's caused a little bit of a stupid hubbub on the internet. But singer-actress Halle Bailey, not Halle Berry, but Halle Bailey, is the new Ariel. Now, this caused a little bit of a firestorm online because everybody knows Ariel's got that bright red hair. She's a ginger, you know, hey, you know, because she has no soul. Just kidding to my ginger friends out there and my listeners. But Halle Bailey is a black girl. And so there are some people who, there are even people started petitions. How dare you? The Little Mermaid needs to be a white girl. And it's the most absurd thing. First of all, I didn't hear anybody of these people complain when Chyna Ann McClain was cast as the daughter of Ursula in The Descendants 2, which was another Disney movie. There's nothing about the color of Ariel's skin or the color of her hair that makes that indelible. That she does not have to be a certain... Goldilocks needs to be a blonde. Okay, if you did a movie about Goldilocks, that the character Goldilocks needs to be blonde. There's nothing about Ariel that says she needs to have red hair. That's just a choice that the animators did for her. And I don't even know if that goes back to the Hans Christian Andersen story, but there's a lot of creepy crap in that Hans Christian Andersen story. If you were to actually read that one, it's a nightmare. So what? She's a black girl. You know, people need to get to deal with it. Disney's pushing towards multiracial casting, and it's not just because they're being liberal or progressive. It's because they realize that their movies are being watched by a majority of non-white audiences because it's going overseas. There's a large market that you can reach. And it's not all people who want to see white people on the screen. Sorry, that's just the world. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit really quickly is Knives Out, which is Rian Johnson's new film. It opens on November 27th.
We understand the night of his demise, the family have gathered to celebrate your father's 85th birthday. How was it, by the way?
The party, pre my dad's death? Oh, it was great.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to request that you all stay until the investigation is completed.
What?
Can we ask why? Has something changed?
No.
No, it hasn't changed, or no, we can't ask.
One thing that bothers me about this marketing that you don't actually hear in the radio ad, but in the movie, it's like the whodunit that no one's ever done before. It's kind of building it up a little bit too much. As I'm watching the trailer, I'm like, okay, you don't want to go out there and saying you're the greatest of all time if you're really not, because then you're setting the bar so high. This looks like it could be a fun movie. It could be on that level of, you know, sort of a sarcastic, sardonic, dark humor murder mystery. But I've also seen these movies advertised and completely collapse in practice. And I'll say, Rian Johnson's coming off a very polarizing film, The Last Jedi, which had some real problems with it. And even though they're pushing it because it was a moneymaker, I don't know if that's what you really want to be associated with. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Jumanji, The Next Level, opens on December 13th.
I think he went back in. We gotta go get him. Spencer.
Huh?
What?
Who are you?
Oh my God.
You're Spencer's grandfather.
Are we in Florida?
And you?
Milo Walker. Did I die and turn into some kind of a small, muscular Boy Scout?
Are we dead?
This next venture is even more challenging. And remember, the future of Jumanji is in your hands.
Obviously, this is the next Jumanji movie. It's great to see Karen Gillan back again in the short shorts because, you know, that speaks to me. This looks like it's kind of taken it in a different angle with some of the casting decisions. Of course, you still got the same avatars of Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart and Jack Black, but they shift around the people who are playing those avatars. I enjoyed the last Jumanji movie. So this one looks like it might be a lot of fun. It looks like it's at least done in the same spirit. It really does look like it's a direct sequel, and it can work because it's a video game and they do sequels to video games all the time. Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, was such a surprise hit a couple years ago and such a breath of fresh air. I'm hoping this one continues it and it doesn't turn into the breath of fresh air while you're standing behind the hippopotamus when it's evacuating. So that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Spider-Man Far From Home and Mon Pa Kettle on Vacation.
Spider-Man! spider can. Spins a web any size. Catches thieves just like flies. Look out! Here comes the Spider-Man.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. With the first film, Spider-Man Far From Home, Nick Fury tries to formally recruit Peter Parker into the Avengers during his school's European trip.
Planning a trip?
Mm-hmm. Going to Europe. School trip.
Did you get your passport? Peter Parker here to pick up a passport, please.
Mini toothpaste?
Mm-hmm.
Pack your suit.
I just want to go on my trip with my friends. Europe doesn't really need a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man.
So nice to finally meet you, Spider-Man.
Nick Fury just hijacked our summer vacation.
Are you going to step up or not?
First of all, if you're one of those 5 or 10 people out there who've not seen Avengers Endgame, go see it before you see this movie. Because it spoils the ending of Endgame. And it's okay that it does. It's part of a series, technically. You've had Endgame out for, what, 3 months now or something like that? You've had plenty. It's made billions of dollars. It's you've had your chance to see Endgame in the theaters. There's no big packed showings of that anymore. And this greatly connects to it. And part of the thing that makes this movie work is because it does deal with the fallout of Endgame. And I remember after I saw the last Avengers movie, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, how are they going to fit this in? However everything played out at the end of Avengers, the day-to-day construction of how the world works. And they do. They address that in this movie, but they do it in a very Marvel way. Because when you deep dive into what happened in Endgame, it can become kind of a nightmare and problematic. And they make a note to that in this movie. There's a scene where Aunt May is giving a talk, and she talks about what happened to her. And you're like, yeah, this is something that would be a problem. This is something that would have to be shaken out that was not solved at the end of Endgame. So they put these in there, but they also kind of frame it in a somewhat whimsical, fun manner. And that works. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why these Marvel movies tend to do well and continue to do well. It's not that people are like ever going to get tired of superheroes, because you always have superheroes. There have been superhero movies since the 40s, people. They're not going away. And the only reason we have more of them now is because special effects had finally caught up to it. When you made Superman the movie back in 1978, that took a lot of money to make a really good Superman movie. Now you can make digital effects allow you to do it much more streamlined, and it can work better. And that's why you're getting so many of them. But you always had science fiction and adventure, and, you know, Flash Gordon back in the 30s of the serial, that was essentially a superhero movie. So those of you said, oh, I don't like superhero movies, when's this going to end? The answer, never. It's never going to end. It's not going to end. I mean, you might have it might die down a little bit, but right now, I mean, Spider-Man Far From Home is making tons of money already. I mean, it opened on Tuesday night with the highest Tuesday ever for a Marvel movie. So this is more to come, but the reason that the Avengers movies work and the reason that the Marvel movies work is exactly what makes this movie work, is it's just a fun movie. They get back to framing it as being fun. Not everything has to be dark and heavy and morose, and I think that's one of the things that helped stab the Achilles heels of the DC universe, is they wanted to go too dark for everything. And it's okay to have a little bit of darkness and heaviness in Avengers Endgame, because there's a lot that happened. But pick it up and have some fun with the next movie, which they're doing with Far From Home. Also, you have to look at what Far From Home is. It's essentially just a teen comedy. It's this kid who's going on this trip, and he's got this awkward secret, and he's wanting to hang with his friend and talk to the girl he likes. But it's also a superhero movie in the background, because you got Nick Fury here meddling with his life, and you got this new threat that he's trying to help stop as Spider-Man. And it basically makes a fun, whimsical, cute little movie, and they bring in Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury, and it totally works. I mean, honestly, right now, Samuel L. Jackson is turning into the glue for these movies. I mean, he was the glue that really helped Captain Marvel work as a movie earlier this year. Marvel knows how to pace this stuff out. Now with this, you get a taste of what might come later, because just because the Avengers Endgame kind of ended that Infinity Stone cycle does not mean they're done making these movies. They've got a whole bunch more slated. They're going to be doing new phases, and they're going to keep making these films because people respond to them, and they're a lot of fun. They're enjoyable escapist movies, and that's exactly what Spider-Man Far From Home is. I had a lot of fun watching this movie. It works with the characters that it does. It, like the Homecoming movie, it made it big enough that there were real threats, but it was still small enough that it didn't require all the rest of the Avengers to show up. And it's something that you could just have a couple characters still give a story of Peter Parker, an immature superhero. He's still a teenager and he's still trying to figure out his life. So he's not perfect as Spider-Man. Now, when he's like in his 20s or 30s, maybe Spider-Man's going to need a little bit more, flaws in him in some other way. But this worked. I thought this was a lot of fun. It's totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Ma and Pa Kettle on Vacation. The infamous hillbillies are invited by a relative to France, only to be caught up in a smuggling mystery.
The screen's queen of comedy, Marjorie Mame, and her hilarious sidekick, Percy Kilbride, are back in Ma and Pa Kettle on Vacation.
Elizabeth and Jonathan wanted to go to Paris with
them. Paris, France?
Well, it ain't Paris, Kentucky.
And what hilarious excitement when they offer to trap a dangerous spy ring.
We'll put them behind the sofa.
Ma's in trouble, boys. I mean, my wife. Follow me.
For years, I mean, decades, my father and my mom to a lesser degree, but my father would joke and he'd say, oh, well, you know, these old Ma and Pa Kettle movies. He always kind of dismissed them. And I'd never seen them. I had always thought that they were earlier movies, like from the 30s, but they're not. They're from the 50s. And I'd never seen one. And so I was like, you know, he's mentioned it so many times and he was over once. I said, let's watch this. And you know what? We both had kind of a blast watching this movie. It's not great and it's not high art, but it's sort of the absurd comedy. It's the Beverly Hillbillies before the Beverly Hillbillies came out. The whole point of Ma and Pa Kettle is there were these basically dirt farmers who ended up, I think they won the lottery in a previous film and they moved to a really nice modern fancy house, but there were still hillbillies living in there and they got something like 86 children and they're super old. So I don't know how they avoided menopause through this whole thing, but Marjorie Main plays Ma Kettle and she's the better known of the two. And you even heard it in the trailer. She's the anchor star of the movie and she's a hoot because she's the brash salt of the earth woman. And Pa Kettle's this, you know, kind of frail, kind of, you know, nimbly guy, but he's always trying to run a scheme and get, you know, mooch off of other people. And it's them going, it's an absurd, silly 50s comedy. And it has, you know, it has hijinks, but, you know, it has 50s hijinks, which has people running around Keystone Cop style, only they're in France. But you know what? These Ma and Pa Kettle movies are, these are cute. I've never seen them before. I thought it was an interesting thing to go back and look at. And they have a certain sort of reverence that, like, TCM will bring them back now and then. But they're fun and they're cute. Some of them are hard to find because there's like 7 or 8 of them. They're not readily available, but I, as I understand, they do show up on the cable stations periodically, and they're short. I think this one's like 70 minutes long. That was at a time where it was like, you know, one of these short, and the kids could go in and watch movies over and over again, and they put cartoons and newsreels and all that kind of stuff in front of it, so you'd have a 2-2.5 hour block. But yeah, Ma and Pa Kettle on Vacation, surprisingly, was a breezy, entertaining, fun little movie that's silly and a nice diversion from all the other horribleness in the world today. So, Ma and Pa Kettle on Vacation rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Midsommar and The Last Starfighter. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Midsommar. I think that's how you say it. I've been saying that on the radio all week, so I'm an idiot if I got it wrong. My apologies to everybody in Sweden and the entire country itself if I mispronounce it. If not, then suck it, everybody else. I know what I'm doing, and I am a man of the world. The director of Hereditary follows up with a story of a couple traveling to Sweden for a midsummer festival with violent and disturbing intentions.
I invited Danny to come to Sweden.
You know what she's been going through?
Christian says you've got this special week planned.
It's sort of a crazy festival.
Special ceremonies and dressing up?
That sounds fun.
Tomorrow's a big day.
Is it scary? What am I going through?
We just need to acclimate.
I don't want
to
acclimate. I want to go.
Absolutely not.
First off, you may not remember, but last year when Hereditary came out, I absolutely hated that movie. I loathed it. It was one of what I considered the worst, one of the worst movies of last year. It was a very polarizing movie. I remember it came out, it did well, but it got like a D cinema score. And that's not uncommon with horror films, because what ends up happening with horror films is that it's weird, because horror film fans can rate a movie with a very low cinema score, but it will still do well. It's weird. If you look at the movies that get an F cinema score, sometimes it's movies like, what was that one? It was like the Devil Inside or something like that, with some found footage movie. It got an F cinema score, but it had a huge box office opening. What ends up happening is there's the horror fans are very fickle, and they want a certain type of movie, and everybody wants something different. So when they go to a movie and they don't get it, they kind of trash the movie. Horror movies tend to be front-loaded that way, that horror movie fans will go give everything a chance, but be a little more critical on it, as opposed to, I think, comedy fans and romantic comedy fans and action movie fans. They target a little bit more to what they specifically want to see in the theaters. But Hereditary just didn't, it was a very polarizing film. And I know people who thought it was the greatest movie of the year. They may be wrong, they may be absolutely wrong, and in my opinion, they are. But it was a polarizing movie. It got a lot of buzz, and it got a lot of attention, and it got some awards at the end of the year. And Toni Collette was fine in that movie. I don't have a problem with her. I have a problem with Ari Aster's, the way he directed it. He just dragged out all the grief and emotion unnecessarily. And I didn't think he had any sort of really new tricks up his sleeve. He was just doing what other people had done, only slower. This movie is different, and I find it an interesting follow-up because, first of all, it's going to be very polarizing. Very much like Hereditary, this is not for everyone. I believe earlier this week, because it opened the same day that Spider-Man did, but it's well under it in terms of box office, it's somewhere in like a C+ range cinema score, which is not good for a regular movie, but is sustainable as a horror film. But that doesn't bode well for its legs as it moves on into the next weeks. But it's getting a lot of good buzz from the critical perspective. So people will remember it when award season comes to it. I liked this much better than Hereditary. And the reason I liked it is because it was a better made movie. Hereditary, I thought, was derivative of a lot of other things and not done effectively. One of the things with Hereditary reminded me of a complaint that Stephen King had with Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. And of all the complaints he has a point here. When Wendy finds the all work and no play stack of papers, she's flipping through them, flipping through them, flipping through them, and she's supposed to be surprised from behind by Jack Nicholson. And they cut to Jack Nicholson sneaking up on her. And I remember Stephen King said, well, the whole point is to get the scare, and you lost that option. And I know Kubrick had a different reasoning for it, and it goes deeper into the film there. But if you just talk about sheer horror, and he's right, that's how you should pace that scene. Now, in Hereditary, my problems with Hereditary was they would have these long, drawn-out suspense moments, and you turn the corner, and there'd be either nothing, but there was no payoff. And maybe he had a point of doing that, but I thought it was pretentious and garbage. In Midsommar, they have a similar slow burn. It takes its time. The movie certainly breathes. And they go to this place in Sweden that's up north, so they have the midnight sun. It never gets fully dark out there. So the thing that they're playing with is making a horror movie in the brightness. And that's very hard to do, because most horror movies go there to haunt. Like if you look at like Annabelle Comes Home from the other week, that's a movie where it takes place in dark and shadows, and it's this haunted house, and it's at nighttime, and it plays to that really well. The reason Midsommar is such an experiment is because it's all bright and it's well lit and it's a beautiful landscape. You're not in a scary location, but the disturbing things are happening. I'm not going to say scary. It's also not a surprise movie. And I think he handled it better than he did with Hereditary, because it felt like there were supposed to be surprises in Hereditary that didn't work. Whereas in this one, there really are no surprises. There's literally a scene where they walk by this mural of something and it tells you everything is going to happen. You just have to interpret it. But everything that happens in this movie, you know, is coming. And he's basically milking the horror there, and he's milking the emotions, and there's a lot of like subtext with mental illness and codependency and relationships. So I think there's a lot to be said, and it's a movie to be dissected. But even so, it's a slow burn, and it has some unpleasant moments. I think it's effectively, it does milk it too much, and I do think he drags it out a bit too much. But overall, I found it a fascinating experiment to have this horror movie take place in the bright light. I've not, since Insidious 2, when they go into the, what is it, the Beyond or the Hereafter, wherever they go into when they go find the ghost, it's all brightly lit. And I said, that was an interesting experiment that James Wan did. It wasn't effective as much as it could have been. I think Ari Aster makes a better push to do that. It still is a challenge for a filmmaker to make a scary movie in bright, bright, bright lights. But I'm still going to say that Midsommar kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Last Starfighter. In this 1980s alien adventure, a kid from a trailer park is recruited to defend an interplanetary Star League against an invading armada.
It started with a game. But it wasn't just any game.
You have been recruited by the Star League to defend the frontier against Zur and the Kodan Armada.
And then one night...
Centauri's the name. We have to talk about a matter of utmost importance. Welcome to Rylos, my boy.
You were recruited by the Star League to defend
the frontier against Zur and the Kodan Armada.
I'm bringing this back for a couple reasons. First of all, this movie is celebrating its 35th anniversary next week. Also, I remember seeing this movie when I was, 13 years old? And I loved it. It was a great movie for my age at the time. And you watch this now and it's cheesy, but it's still fun to look back at, and it's a storyline that works. It's the computer game that was used as a recruitment tool. You know, this was sort of post-Star Wars science fiction, this kind of stuff you got in the mid-80s, but it was before things always had to be heavy and dark and rough, and that sort of thing started happening in the late 80s into the 90s. But right now, it was still sort of gee whiz bubblegum, brightly colored sci-fi, and I had a lot of fun with this. As a kid, the other thing that's interesting about this movie, it's one of the first films to use full CGI elements. And you watch it now, and it looks like a real cheap video game. But back then, in the big screen, to watch this stuff, you know, the gun stars, the ships that they had, and the battles, all that stuff happening in space, that was all done by a computer. And that happens now, but... back then, that was one of the first movies that used that much computer power to do the special effects. And it doesn't hold up. The special effects do not hold up now, but they looked amazing back then, and there's a certain level of nostalgia with this. Plus, it had like Robert Preston in one of his final roles, which is him essentially playing the music man as a guy recruiting for the Starfighters. This movie's silly, and kids today, millennials are going to watch it and think it's dumb. But for me, as a kid of the 80s, this was a great movie and one of the most Amblin-esque kind of movies that wasn't actually an Amblin movie. The Last Starfighter, part of my childhood, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to talk quickly about the box office and then do the home cinema roundup featuring Dumbo and Cinderella. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now that we've finished up the movie reviews, let's talk about the box office really quickly. Now, some of it, the box office has actually happened this week with Spider-Man. Spider-Man's doing extremely well. Midsommar's not, it's a way huge dip from Spider-Man to what Midsommar's doing in terms of the midweeks. But really, you don't expect that one to do extremely well. The thing that's neat about it is Spider-Man's on its way to making a very good weekend number. And that's cool because, again, it shows there isn't a superhero fatigue. There isn't a sequel fatigue. It's just you got to make movies that people want to see. And I think that Spider-Man is different enough. It's still with the Marvel Universe, and that makes it fun to watch and makes it an entertaining ride. Now, of course, last week, we saw once again another slowdown, which is going to be picked up a bit this week simply because Spider-Man is kind of goosing the box office. But Toy Story 4 came in again with about $60 million to win, but that's still lower than what they were hoping initially. It had about a 50% drop, which a movie like that should be less than 50%. Annabelle Comes Home made just over $20 million, which is not good in comparison to the other Annabelle movies. The only thing that would save this is the production budget being relatively small. And then yesterday actually did pretty well, a $17 million for a movie that is that independent smaller film. Yesterday did pretty well last weekend. So we're in for some box office goosing this week, and I think this is going to continue to play through the weekend with Spider-Man doing quite well and showing that Marvel still knows what it's doing in terms of marketing its films. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. These are a couple that I did not cover last week. I had too much to cover. And so I kind of pushed these 1 week because they're still valid. It's 4th of July week and weekend. They tend not to release a whole lot of movies right on 4th of July. It's not a big DVD week. It's more going to the movies to see it. It sort of reminds me a little bit of like the week after Christmas. These are these two times in this year where you have these dips because nobody wants to release anything after Christmas because everyone's bought their gifts already. And if you have gift cards, you want to have stuff in the stores or available on Amazon right away. So you get this dip between Christmas and New Year. And you also get this dip right around 4th of July where there's not a whole lot of DVDs and Blu-rays released. But there were a couple released last week that are worth talking about. And the first one I want to hit is Dumbo. Tim Burton directs this modern adaptation of the classic Disney film about a young elephant with ears so large it can fly.
Welcome, baby Dumbo. We're all family here, no matter how small.
You have something very rare. You have wonder. You have mystique. You have magic. Come with me. Together, we can soar on an elephant's wings.
It's weird because I was both very impressed and unimpressed at the same time. And I watching it again on home video, I was able to zero in on the stuff I liked and the stuff that left me cold. I think the production design's gorgeous. You always get beautiful production design with a Tim Burton movie. I mean, it's stark. It's sort of that Art Deco historical look to it. It's sort of exists in this time that never really existed in the world. And you have this weird, bizarre look to things. So Tim Burton always brings a real darkness and twisted, weird creature look to everything he does. And that makes a cool film. It has its problems, though, even with the look of the film. And one of my problems with the look of the film, which I finally realized as I'm watching this, it feels like the entire movie shot against a green screen. And part of it is because you want to have this prairie look to the film of if this the circus in the middle of nowhere stopping in these small towns in the Midwest where you have these sunsets and you don't have modern technology behind them. It's very hard to achieve that with just practical locations now, because at the very least you got telephone lines and jets flying overhead, and you've got modern cities in the background, and you didn't have that in the time when this Dumbo film takes place. So what I think they did is they shot it against a blue screen so they can have a total control of what's behind them. And in the process, of course, they made it always taking place at magic hour. The sun's setting and it looks beautiful. I'm from the Midwest. I know how gorgeous the Midwest sunset can look. And I've been out in the middle of a field somewhere where there's really just train tracks and trees, and it looks cool. And I think that they achieved that. But the problem is, in achieving it, it still looks like it was shot in a studio. You don't get this feel that you're really at a circus, that you're really at something that exists in reality. And that's okay when they move farther along and they go to the Michael Keaton circus where it's bigger and cooler. But this one just seemed a little, it just seems overly manufactured. And while this has a cute little story and I give it credit for doing different things than what you had in the original Dumbo movie, because that movie's like an hour long and that's it. But it's not Dumbo's movie. He's sort of a side character, and he flies very early in the movie. So I think it's neat that they approached it differently, but they spend so much time not making it Dumbo's movie. And it's almost so different that they bend over backwards to have elements from the original movie, like the pink elephants on parade scene that just, it's him sort of looking at bubbles. I don't know if he's having an acid trip or something like that, or the little mouse in the ringmaster's outfit. That's just a mouse in the circus, but there's no character to it. So they have these little Easter eggs that, of course, Disney even on the DVD talks about, saying, "Hey, there's this little featurette that talks about all that stuff." It removed too much of it away that it's less of a Dumbo movie. It's still neat and it's still cute and it's still sweet. And for the most part, the message works, but it does also feel absurd when they're like, "Look at these giant ears. What's that doing on an elephant?" I'm like, it's an elephant. Elephants have big ears. And it's not like Dumbo's ears are absurdly big. They're just big, especially for an Asian elephant. Now, if he were an African elephant, his ears would be that big. It just doesn't ring terribly true. But it's cute enough to see. And I mean, the DVD has plenty of stuff. The Blu-ray has stuff. It has, some behind the scenes to it. It talks about the adaptation to it. It has a whole bunch of deleted scenes. It looks at the Easter eggs and it has a music video and a gag reel. So overall, it still kind of rocks as a movie, but it's not quite Dumbo. And I think that's its biggest problem. But I'll still say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the home cinema roundup and talk about Cinderella. Here's another Disney release that is, I think, about a week old. I want to highlight it now because it is the anniversary edition of Cinderella. It's coming up for its 70th anniversary, which is groundbreaking on itself. In Cinderella, Disney's original animated masterpiece comes out of the vault on Blu-ray for a new edition.
You are the only ladies of the household, I hope, I presume?
There's no one else, Your Grace.
On the stroke of 12, the spell will be broken.
Talagadoola, Menchikaboola, put them together, and what have you got? Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo.
It's like a wonderful dream come true.
Critics say Cinderella is a sheer joy. It's even better than you remember it.
There's not a whole lot you can say about Cinderella because it's been released on DVD, it's been released on VHS, it's been released on Blu-ray before. So this is not the first time you get it on Blu-ray, but you have a chance to get it on Blu-ray. And that's one of the things Disney does, is it releases stuff and then puts it in the vault and goes out of print. And if you've been itching to get your hands on a copy of Cinderella, now you can. And it's a great movie, especially if you want that classic Disney princess history and you want that shelf that has all those elements to it. Because we've got Sleeping Beauty, we've got Snow White, we've got Little Mermaid, we've got recent ones as well as the original classics. And in the Disney edition, one thing Disney always does is when they bring out a new DVD or a new Blu-ray, they throw in some more special features because it has all the vintage stuff. It has all the stuff from previous DVD and Blu-ray releases, the bonus features about, they have the intro. And this is also for a movie that's 70 years old. So it's not like you're getting the original director or stars to do a lot with it, but you do have some older classic bonus features that do feature some of the people involved in the film itself. Now, there's some new stuff. You've got a trivia track, which is always kind of fun to watch, especially if you've seen the movie before. You can pop it on there. And then there's what's called In Walt's Words Enhanced Edition. And they'll do this a lot where they'll take archival stuff from Walt Disney himself, whether it's like storyboards or photos or sketches or transcripts, and they'll add that into the presentation of the film, so you get a perspective of what Walt Disney was doing himself with Cinderella. And that stuff I've always found fascinating. So that's in there. And I'll have to say, Cinderella is a beautiful movie. It's a great movie. I mean, I've reviewed it a dozen times, but it's still worth seeing. It's one of the original Disney classics, and it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Crawl and Stuber. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.